ॐ सहना भवतु सहना भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः
तं दूरदर्शनं गुरुम् अनुप्रविष्टम् तं दूरदर्शनं गुरुम् अनुप्रविष्टम् गुहाहितं गह्वरेष्टं पुराणं गुहाहितं गह्वरेष्टं पुराणम् अध्यात्मयोगाधिगमेन देवम् अध्यात्मयोगाधिगमेन देवम् मत्वा धीरो हर्षशोख्यौ जहाति मत्वा धीरो हर्षशोख्यौ जहाति तं दूरदर्शनं गूढम् अनुप्रविष्टं गुह आहितं गुहाहितं गह्वरेष्टं पुराणम् अध्यात्मयोग Adigamena, as a compound, Adhyatma Yoga Adigamena, Devam, Matva, Diraha, Harshashokau, Jahati. Okay? In the previous verses, Lord Yama has been really praising Nachiketas in many different ways. In the last verse he said, you know, the dhiraha, such as you, that wise person who has viveka, who has this discrimination, that dhiraha is viveka and vairagya, that discrimination between what is temporal and what is permanent, recognizing that there's no ananda or fullness to be gained here. Only temporary little spurts of it, that's about it. So he says, to Nachiketas, you as a dhiraha, you having this viveka, you have actually, without wavering in any way, like a still lake, as I've given, shown you all of these wonderful things within samsara that you can have, and not a ripple has taken place in your mind. You know? And without a ripple, having seen all of these things that I've been offering you, you have completely turned your back on every one of them. Okay? Without the slightest ripple. That's a dhiraha. And he says, and that also, that requires some, what he says, dhritya. Swamiji translates that as with a courage, has some courage. There's has to be a lot of clarity there. A lot of clarity because you're actually rejecting the entire creation as being a source of ananda for you. That requires commitment, and a commitment to your, I was going to say, it's really a commitment to the obvious. But sometimes it's hard to have the commitment to the obvious. The obvious is the recognition that, let me just check something, I want to make sure that this is good, or that we had it. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The obvious is that recognition that, you know, finite gains, finite attempts, finite actions can only give finite results. That is a no-brainer, right? If you're doing something that existing within time, then if it's within time, then all of the elements involved in that action, in that karma, whatever it is, is subject to time. Time means continual change. That means no matter what you're doing, you can't, all of a sudden everything, you know, everything's in motion, 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 just because that's the nature of things. And you're kind of messing with that motion, that continual motion, until for a moment, everything that's still in flux is perfect. Perfect. So I feel so happy. This is exactly what I wanted, but there's no such thing as a snapshot. You know? Okay. It's perfect now. Stop. No. There is no stopping. Of any of the players, no stopping from the karta, the one who's doing, you know, no stopping from the sense organs or the body, or for the objects, or for the emotions. Think of it, you've achieved something and now you have a vritti, you have a thought modification of sukha. We call it a sukha vritti. A sukha vritti means that my mind is, for that moment, has a lot of shanti and is experiencing ananda. It has an ananda experience, an experience of joy. The problem is that it's a sukha vritti. Vritti. The vritti means it's a thought modification. Have you ever had a thought modification that stayed? Have you ever had an emotion, positive or negative, that stayed? We have to say no, and it would be very strange. But I wish they would. I wish they would. We don't even think like that. All we know is we want to be happy, that's all. And we get glimpses of happiness, but what we're getting are glimpses, we're getting thought modifications of shantivrittis, which by their very nature are subject to change because they exist within the creation. So the person who has figured this out, that requires a twofold thing, viveka and vairagya. You've recognized that all of these gains are finite, that all of the experiences of ananda are time-bound. Finite means time-bound. Everything that you do is time-bound, and all of the results of what you do is also time-bound. And that's the law. You can't break the law. That's the order of the creation. And when you realize that, there's another realization that comes. Every single thing that I'm doing, all of my aspirations, are not going to give me what I seek. They will only give me glimpses in terms of my own ananda. What is interesting here is that once you discover the source of ananda, which is your own being, once your mind discovers that, because up until that point of discovery, it's being projected out and I'm running after it. You know, I'm running after that sukha. It's not just sukha. It's that feeling that all is well with me. And I think if I can get this and get that and get this, and of course I need that too, you know, I can reach that. I've achieved what is to be achieved. It's called krita kritya. What is to be done has been done. Swamiji throws this little word out all the time. You're a kritik for jnani. When it's jnana-nishta, you're a krita krityaha. You're a person for... Kriti means that which is to be done, that which is to be accomplished. Krita, that has been done. You are krita krityaha. What is to be done by you in order to be success, to be a whole, full, complete person that says all is well with me, you know? You'll be able to say that, you think, if I can just get the right combination of things. But at some point you realize that that's not possible, because of the very nature of the creation is not possible. When I really see that, I have that viveka, what is born, kind of a cause-effect relationship, what is born of the viveka is vairagya. Cause-effect, if I have the viveka, that discrimination, vairagya means I lose interest in those things completely in terms of my belief that they will actually give me the wholeness or the well-being that I have made it now, you know, that is gone. You realize that that's a fallacy, that this world cannot do that. Just by the order of the world, by the very nature of time. So when you totally get that, then all the shama, dhamma, upadati, all of these states of mind that have to do with shanti or peace start developing, because the world, you're not seeking things out of the world anymore. You're not asking the world to be make you happy. It's kind of a dark night of the soul initially, because that viveka vairagya, it creates a mumukshutvam, which says, makes you a seeker. The mumukshutvam means that I can't solve this problem. And so Nachiketa's realized that in full measure. And so he had the opportunity of being with Lord Yama. Mm. That if anybody knows what's really going on, and if there's anything about me that survives and is beyond this samsara, beyond time, as we'll see, he's going to ask in a minute, beyond time, it would be Lord Yama, the one who's the Lord of death. Lord Yama would know if there's anything that survives death. If you say anything that survives death, it's anything that survives time. Is there anything, if I say anything that survives time, is the same as saying, is there anything about me that is free from time? If there's something about me that's free from time, it's free from change. So this is the questioning that Nachiketa is going through in his mind, and he has realized that there's no better teacher than Yama, than Lord Yama, for this. Mm-hmm. And so even though Yama is tempting him, and the reason for good reason, he's tempting him to see whether Nachiketa really wants this knowledge, wants to know this, you know, or does he really, it's like Yama would be saying, is he really asking what I think he's asking? Yeah. Is he really asking that? Well, let's see. How would you like these things? How would you like these things? How would you like to have long and very healthy life, and for your children to have a long, healthy life, and then you have to afford them, and so you need a lot of wealth, and you need a lot of land, so everybody can have their own homes and everything, you know? And then you should have a lot of enjoyments also. And you should have some power, some overlordship. That's the people look up to you and respect you, and you can make your own decisions. You don't have somebody looking out of you. All of these things you can have. And you can also have all of these beautiful women, the women that we have here that you can't get down there. You can have them. You can have them too. All of that. You know? And Nachiketa said, nothing happens. Because he's seen so clearly, all of those things, you know, are time-bound, and they just wear out your senses, you know. Even if they last, you won't. Now, say they're all just sitting there very stable. They have a longer lifespan than you do, you know. So they'll outlast you, but that's just the problem. They will outlast you, and they'll wear out your senses, which is exactly what Nachiketa says. So now Yama is quite convinced. And so he says, having realized that Nachiketa knows what he's asking for, right? And he has understood. So that means that he has what we call the sadhana chatushtaya. He has this he is an adhikari. And adhikari means he's a person who is qualified for this knowledge. You know, Swamiji kind of uses the example sometimes, like say you want to learn calculus. You want to be a mathematician, you want to take a class in calculus. This is actually his example. You want to take a class in calculus. So you want to be a mathematician. But you haven't even had any algebra yet, you know. So before that you can take that class in calculus, there's some other things that you have to have understood, you know. And so a person who is an adhikari for calculus has to have a mind that's available for that. Because they have a certain amount of knowledge, a certain amount of understanding to be able to deal with that. And so when Yama was listening to Nachiketa's, does Nachiketa's have the qualities that are necessary to actually be asking me what I think he's asking me? Does he have those qualifications? Because it's a big question. I mean, if you're serious about the question, it's a very big question. It's the who am I question, not who am I in terms of this dream world, but who am I really? Is there somebody that survives time? It's like, is there somebody who survives you, O Yama? Is there somebody that survives you? It's like, is there somebody who survives time? That's what I want to know. And you would be the one to know it. So now Yama, having could be more convinced, he now says, and Shankar gives him the introduction in his little introductory sentence. He goes like this, he says, that self, so now Yama is as though saying this to Nachiketa's, that self which you want to know, that Atma which you want to know, he goes, Tam, that is Dur Darshan. It's very difficult to see. Dur Darshan. It's very difficult to see. See means recognize. You're not going to be able to see it with your eyes or see it with your sense organs, because that would be, you would be an object within time that you're looking at. So yourself, even though it's self-evident, because it's self-evident, because it's consciousness, it's self-shining, it's not something, it's something which is a constant in your experience, not in subject terms of subject-object, but in terms of being self-evident, you know? So that self-evident me that is always shining is very difficult to see, because we only know about seeing in terms of subject-object relationship. So it's that Atma that you're asking about is Dura Darshan. It's very difficult to see. It's Gudam Anupravishtam. It has entered very deeply into secrecy. It is a great secret. It is a great secret, because what you want to see is actually the self of the seer. What you are seeking is the self of the seeker. Right? And so say the seeker wants, or the one who is seeing, you're looking and looking for something. But what you're looking for is the very self of the one who's looking. That's hard. That's going to be hard. What greater secret, so that Gudam Anupravishtam, it has entered into secrecy. How has it entered into secrecy? Was it ever not a secret? Is the idea? How did it enter into secrecy? By the very nature of the creation, it becomes a secret. With the manifestation of the creation, with all of the jivas, for each jiva, it is a great secret. Because just by the very fact of, it's not like you had a prior condition of knowledge. Right? Your body, mind, sense organs, like, let's look at it like this. The dream comes. You have a dream. Okay? All of the jivas in the dream, all of the individuals in the dream, have a body, mind, sense organs. They have means of knowledge that are there, and hands and feet, etc., all kind of meant for the experience of the dream world. That's what they're meant for. That's their epistemological limits that they all have. All of your sense organs and your mind has is the subject-object relationship. So I am very qualified to experience and to know. I have the pramanas necessary to know this world. But what pramanas, what means of knowledge do I have to know myself? Now, see this problem. I can be myself, and myself is self-evident. Like, say you're just sitting there, and I ask, you know, what are you like? What are you? Well, you take it all to be, I'm this person, this body, mind, sense, organs person who has this thought and these parents and all this kind of stuff. But you're talking about you who has all these things. So it's not that this you, this me, is not unknown. It is known. It's experienced. I am my own self-experience. But that experience is not knowledge. Right? So I'm both known and unknown. The example we use for this is if you know the two boys walking along and they see one boy, it's at dusk, and one boy of the two mistakes a rope for a snake. Right? He mistakes the rope for a snake, but he is experiencing that rope in the terms of, you know, that if it's 5 bends, it's 4 feet long, it's 1 inch in diameter, it has these little twiggy things sticking out. He experiences the rope, but he experiences the rope as a snake. What's actually there is only a rope, but see how he is experiencing that rope, but not as a rope. He experiences the rope, the object rope, as this, just as this. I experience me just as me. But this me that I experience as me, not as an object, but just I just take for granted my own being, right? But I don't realize that my being is free of this body, mind, sense organs, all of the things that we call an upadhi, a conditioning adjunct. It's all mixed together. Right? And so even though the me experience is exactly who I am, is Brahman, it is exactly what I need to know, I only experience it contextually from the standpoint of the upadhis, the conditioning adjuncts. It's my mind that's making a commentary on me. I'm not making a commentary on myself, I simply am. But my mind is saying, you know, I am sad or I am happy or, you know, I am not well because it's identified with the physical body, you know, or I'm getting myself into good shape or I'm going to school or I'm doing whatever I'm doing. It's I, all in reference to the upadhis, not in reference to just me. It never would even occur to the mind. No, this is the thing. It need not ever occur to the mind. That it occurs to the mind is considered a huge punya. You know, crores and crores and crores of punya give a person that type of a buddhi that has enough inner space and quietude to even think about doing this type of viveka. Because it need not. It need not, because your buddhi is never away from yourself. So why should the buddhi not just say, I am the self? Why shouldn't the pot just say, I am clay? Because it is. It is clay. Why shouldn't the buddhi say, I am me? Because it is me. What it doesn't recognize, it doesn't have the viveka to recognize that the me that it depends on for its being is actually free of it. It doesn't see that. Why does it have to see it? Once a mirror is held up, which we call the pramana, once that mirror is held up to somebody who wants to see it, is ready to see it, then it's, as Shankara says, oh my God, how could we not see this? It's so completely obvious. But it is not obvious until it is obvious, you know? So what you are seeking, I want to be whole, I want to be complete, I don't want to die. No. I want to be happy, I don't want to die, but I also don't want to be happy. I have to be happy and live. I have to be happy, healthy, and live. I have to have well-being, that all is well with me, you know, which the universe cannot give me, but that is what I seek. So where can it be found in the universe? Do darshanam, that's not gonna, we're not gonna find it there in the universe. That's what makes a person a viveki, vairagya, mumukshu, you know? So what we discover and what Yama is starting to teach now is this is very difficult to see because it is hidden, he says, you know, it has entered into deep hiding. Just by the fact of the creation itself, the nature of the creation itself. It has entered into ajnanam. It is covered by ajnanam, by self-ignorance. And it is, he says, it is guhahitam. It is there abiding in the buddhi. Right? It's not abiding in the buddhi as a pea in a pod, but it's abiding in your buddhi just like, you know, the clay is abiding in the pot. The self is abiding in your buddhi, in your mind, like the clay is abiding in the pot. The clay is resting there in the pot. Is the clay really resting in the pot? Yeah. Is the Atma really resting, abiding there in the Buddhi? Well, not exactly. But from the standpoint of the Buddhi, from the standpoint, not exactly, because there's, for the clay pot example, there's only clay there. There really is no pot. The pot is mithya. For the Buddhi, there is no Buddhi that is not me. There's no part of the Buddhi that is not me. That's what we mean by mithya. Mithya means this, when I, this experience that I have of duality, if I give it an order of reality, I say it's mithya. What does that mean? It has no being at all. Zero. Nothing apart from me. I am its self. I am the upadana karana. I am the material cause. I am what is actually here. Anything that you think is here, you can disassemble it into an infinite regress. You can never find a thing here. And everything, besides not being able to find a thing here, because everything is infinitely divisible, everything also comes into being and goes out of being. So it just means there's nothing here, really. And yet we experience it. That's maya. Ya, ma, iti, maya. That which is not, that is maya. This is not, in the sense that it has no being at all apart from me. And yet, we have a name for it, maya, because we experience it. We experience it even though it has no being away from me. And so, in terms of the buddhi, right, I'm abiding there in the buddhi as its very self. The buddhi is mithya, I am satyam. The pot is mithya, the clay is satyam. The buddhi is mithya, I am the satyam. Because in my experience, I never change. I need the viveka for this. Something's changing. This is why this knowledge is so available to you. It's so available to all of us. If somebody's holding up the mirror, if that pramana is working, it is so available. Because mithya is continually revealing itself. Because anything that changes, anything that comes into being and goes out of being, it's not me. It's mithya. You can't say I am that thing that's gone. I'm here, it's gone. I can't be that. So any moment, if you just take the experiences that you have just as a human being, if you can get rid of that experience, or it can just pass naturally, if it can come and go, it's not you. From the standpoint of the experience, you can say, yes, it is me, like the pot can say, I am the clay. But the clay is going to say, yes, you are me. You're totally dependent on me. There's nothing about you that is not me. You certainly are me. But I am not you. I am not you. You are me, but I'm not you. Because I'm free of you. Right? And so look at this. Every thought, every emotion, every experience that you have, everyone, without exception, right, it is me, and I am free of it. That's what, it is me, because you can't, it's like taking the rope away from the snake and the snake's still there. No, it's not going to happen. Take the clay away from the pot is still there. No, won't happen. Take your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, your perceptions, the world, away from such chit, conscious being, which is me, and you think something will be left there. There'll be nothing left there. Because there won't be any existence. Take existence away from your experience and there is no experience. I, though, am the existence. There's not existence, this isn't something you can look at and say, oh, look at the existence over there. I am that. Right? So, this guha, I'm hidden and I am abiding there in the cave, the guha. The cave is the buddhi. Okay? I'm situated there in the buddhi. And then he says, gahureshtam. Sta, gahura sta. I am abiding in this conglomerate of the body with all of these the various parts, which is kind of a calamity. Because Chuanji says, I'm abiding here, you know, amidst many calamities. Many calamities. Because everything about your body is subject to illness and health and finally and bad health and this and that, and this and that, and finally you die. That's it. So, You know, and my mind is also calamitous because every sukha is a dukkha yoni. It's a womb for dukkha. There, you're just abiding here in this one big calamity. Right? That's compilation. Okay. The only thing is, because mitya, the calamities part is mitya, you know, and you are satyam. You are satyam means you're free from past, present, and future. You can never be, being can never be negated. So even amidst all these calamities, that's okay. Because that you can use the calamities and anything that exists within time and space, anything, without exception. There are no exceptions to it. You remain there untouched. Absolutely untouched. And so that viveka, the buddhi, that has available to it that viveka, that ability to discriminate the changeless from the changing. There's the changeless me and everything else. There's the one changeless, non-objectifiable me and absolutely everything else. So that's not hard, in a sense, you know. It's not like, well, there's this changeless me and there's this changeless me over here. And this is moving over here, but there's another changeless over... No. There's only one changeless and everything else. Because for something to be changeless, free of change, it can't be exist in time. It can't. So there's not going to be two of them. Time and space go together. You know, when you have the dream comes, the whole dream manifests. The dream comes into manifestation, it sustains, it goes into unmanifest again, but while it's there, it's just continually changing. And you're not, any amount of analysis is not going to get you out of that Maya. You'll just learn more and more about the beautiful complexity of Maya, but you won't get out of it. Right? And to get out of it, how can you get out of it? If you're in it, you can't get out of it, because you yourself are a product of it. So there's no getting out of it. There's only recognizing that you have never been in it and you never will be in it. That's the satyam. That's the truth of the whole thing. But the truth of the whole thing isn't participating as an object within it. See what I mean? So you are ever free. So he says, you are puranam. Puranam means pura, never. You are ancient but ever new. Ancient but ever new. It's a beautiful word. It means this being that I am, if I go back from the standpoint of the creation, billions of years or trillions of years, or I go forward billions of years, trillions of years, I am ancient and ever new. It means my being does not grow old. The being that I am, the conscious being that I am right now, is the conscious being that is free from time. If you go back from the standpoint of the universe of billion years, it is still just me, not an old me. Okay. I am now, this is Wang Jing Dui's question, I am now millions of years old. You can really do it. Now, purana means as ancient and as much time has passed in any given yuga or yugas, I am ever fresh. Nava means ever new. Because free of time. So this me is the same timeless me that was here a moment ago, a year ago, a billion years ago. There is no time and space for me. So that's the puranam. So then he goes, adhyatma yoga adhigamena matva devam matva dhiraha harshashokal jahati. But first he says, matva devam matva, having contemplated upon the deva. Deva is the atma, consciousness, the conscious being. So deva matva, having contemplated on the self, that is ever, ever new, that is puranam, that is situated in this calamitous group of parts that we call all the upadis, the body, mind, sense organs, that is situated, abiding there in the buddhi, that is Gudam Anuparvishtam, that has entered into great secrecy and very difficult to see, to see because non-objectifiable, right? So having contemplated on that, by means of, through or having gained Adhyatma Yoga. So having meditated upon that, having adhigamena, gained that Adhyatma Yoga. Adhyatma Yoga means, Shankara says it really nicely here. He says, for Adhyatma Yoga, Adhyatma means centered on oneself. Yoga means a contemplation, meditation, which is centered on myself. So by having gained that recognition, like in the meditation when we say, for the buddhi, gently just focus on your own presence. When look at what happens when you do that. When you're focusing on your own presence, then as Shankara says right here, Vishaye bhiha prati samhritya means having withdrawn my sense organs from all of the vishayas, from anything I can objectify, I am now gently changing my focus, changing my commitment to my own self. These other things might be there. This is another thing to make clear, because I think in contemplation can get very frustrating if you don't think about it correctly. If the buddhi is changing the focus toward my own being, just toward my own self, these things may be coming and going. The mithya doesn't do anything. It doesn't matter. We can think like in yoga, like pratyahara, where I bring all of my mind so firmly to myself that none of these experiences exist for me. So when you think, if I'm going to just focus on myself, all of these experiences should go away. But actually, if you relax a little bit, you can look at it like this. Your focus, when your focus is on the self, which you recognize because of teaching, you're focusing, you gently change your focus to your own being. That's where your commitment is. That's where the jnana-nishtha is. Okay? So having focused on my own being, then he says, turning away from all of the vishayas, all of the sense objects, then cetasaha atmani samadhanam. The mind, there's the absorption of the mind in myself. Now, these are subtle little things, but they make a huge difference. Right now, if I'm looking at you through my sense organs and I feel myself on the chair and I am aware of whatever little sounds are going on. But just like the clay pot, none of these, this mithya, is in any way covering me. Because the buddhi, which is like the pot of the clay, the buddhi has to have gently shifted its focus so that no matter what is going on, you can have an open-eye meditation if you want to call it like that, whatever is going on, it in no way covers me or disturbs me. Now, that's that Adhyatma Yoga, because I am completely, it's like the buddhi has one foot in, one foot out. We say that about a therapist. The therapist has one foot in, one foot out. You know, you're totally engaged in the experience and all of a sudden, and all with your patient, but you're also very aware of what's going on in the experience as that therapeutic ear. So it's like jnani, yourself is very self-evident. The buddhi is not speaking from, or it is not lost in the mind. It's not lost in the emotions, and therefore speaking out of or living out of those emotions or living out of that ajnanam. It's no longer, that's not where it's rooted. It's rooted in your own being. When it's rooted in your own being, then that is samadhi, like Shankara will say in the Eparokshana Bhuti, so the text will teach at some point. In the end of it, he says, you really have to sit to meditate. Why do you have to sit to meditate? Are you not supposed to walk? Do you have to, can't we walk? And can I walk around or do things and know myself? Or do I have to sit and meditate? And why would that be? Why do I have to sit and meditate? Aren't I always meditating? am I not always, he's got like 10 verses like this, am I not always in Nirvikalpa Samadhi? When am I not in Nirvikalpa Samadhi? Do you think that this is, that this panorama of this Maya creation is taking me out of Nirvikalpa Samadhi? How would that even be possible? You know, so that's the idea. It's not as though this creation or the things, the duality that is taking place is in any way covering you or has any being away from you. And so there is no such thing as the creation taking you away from yourself, because it has no separate being to take you away from yourself. So you are always, in fact, in samadhi. So the one who has gained that adhyatma yoga, adhikamena means by gaining the adhyatma yoga, that meditation on myself, or that jnanam, like yoga, that jnanam of my own being, then having gained that, then such a one, through that knowledge, can, through that gain, can contemplate, having contemplated on the deva as my own self, he says, then such a person, having contemplated on myself through this adhyatma yoga, that diraha, the one who has that viveka and that knowledge, gives up, he jahati, he gives up harsha and shoka. Harsha is horripilation, you know, excitement, joy, and shoka, sorrow. He gives up all of that. What is it? So what he says is, why does he give it up? He gives it up because that utkarsha and upakarsha, that joy and sorrow and horripilation and all of that, harsha and shoka, they don't exist in the Atma. Those things are all maya.
Harsha is humor?
No, harsha is joy. Happiness, joy. You know when you get excited and you're so happy that you got a horripilation on your hair's stand on the end, that's the harsha. And shoka is sad and all of that. But the Atma is neither of those things. Those are all fine, they're all maya. That's not me. My nature isn't a harsha, it's not shoka. It's the ananda, the wholeness, the infinite nature of being itself, which doesn't really compete with harsha and shoka. It's so far superior. the wholeness of your own being is so beautiful compared to what in other verses they'll say is just these little lesha, means just the little scrap of ananda. That we get, it's like throwing little scraps to the poor dogs, you know? That's just this little tiny scrap, or you're having this big whatever it is. You know? Just momentary little scraps, you know, are nothing compared to the nature of your own being. So this harsha and shoka are as though given up in the sense that they're not you. They're not you. When we did the meditation, there's something important about that. I wanted to just take a couple of minutes to talk about the meditation in light of this verse. Because it's a good sadhana. You can always see whether your buddhi, which means also then your speech, the way you're thinking, the way you're acting, the way you're feeling, is that coming, is it an expression of you? Okay. The way you're talking, is it coming from your being, or is it coming from an emotion? Is the way you're acting representative of yourself? So the buddhi is acting on your behalf, the atma. And it's not that the atma is acting, but you are who you are. Is the way that you speak, the way that you walk, the way that you talk, which is was Arjuna's question to Krishna in the end of chapter 2. How does a wise man walk? How does he talk? How does he speak? How does he sit? You know? And Swamiji used to kind of make fun of that question, because you can do it that way. You can legitimately say, he didn't quite understand. You know, he really, Arjuna had, I mean, Krishna had to teach him a lot to make sense of that question. But the question also can be looked at a little bit differently, you know. Like, what is the natural behavior if I'm coming from my own being? You know, how do I speak? It's very beautiful. How do I think? How do I feel? How do I walk? How do I talk? Because I would be coming, that behavior, those emotions would be representative of me. Whereas what happens in samsara is that the buddhi is overwhelmed by my ajnanam. The buddhi is overwhelmed by self-ignorance, first of all. And then being overwhelmed by self-ignorance, it's identified with the emotions and identified with my raga dvesha, my likes and dislikes. It's identified with the situation as to whether this situation is good for me or bad for me, or whether these people make me happy or they make me sad, or this is a good partner for me, all of these type of things. It's speaking from ajnanam. It's speaking from its identification with all of these various situations that are causing me happiness and sorrow, etc. And the buddhi is always speaking from that vantage point. It's speaking out of that emotion, or out of that concern, or out of that worry, because it's been itself overwhelmed, of course, because it doesn't have any knowledge to rest in myself. You see what I'm saying? When the buddhi is resting in my knowledge, resting in myself, then it's a spokesperson for me. Right? It's speaking for me. But if there's no self-knowledge there, then it's speaking for whatever. It's speaking it's speaking for, like, whatever hurt is there, or whatever anger or frustration is there, or whatever joy is there, whatever is there that I'm identified with, whatever upadhi, conditioning adjunct, is primary at that moment, it's speaking from that position. So that's why when we start to understand this, even when we do things that are so helpful for us, working out the inner problems that we have and psychological problems, just think, even this inner child work, what you're actually doing, that's a very beautiful process, because your buddhi is splitting off from the problem. The buddhi, right, the buddhi can be identified with the problem, or it can divide itself into a subject-object from the problem. And so say there's complexes inside in the unconscious or whatnot, and we do inner child work. The buddhi now becomes the subject to the inner child object. You see what I mean? So then I'm now taking care of the problem. I'm not the problem, I'm taking care of the problem. Now, for somebody who has self-knowledge, it's deeper than that. Because the buddhi itself not only is taking care of the problem relatively, still a samsari, but able to have dharma and take care of the problem or the hurt person. Just like, say, if you're a samsari, you don't have self-knowledge or anything, you're a good person and somebody has some problems, you know, and then you take care, you go and you help. Or even toward yourself, the situations that you have going on, you can be a kind voice to taking care of those problems. That means that you become the subject and the problem becomes the object, and you can be kind to the problem. But now, here with knowledge, the buddhi has the self as its being. So the buddhi can't have any better support. It becomes a voice of you, of who you actually are. And who you actually are is so beautiful, so benign, and so strong. You know, like if you look at the Murtis, that gentle smile, or just get in touch with your own being, it is so strong, it's immovable, in the sense you can't shake it, you can't push it over, you can't put a bag over its head, there's nothing you can do to change it. So it is so stable. And then jnana nishtha is when your buddhi becomes rooted, gets used to being a spokesperson, as though, for you. 1 foot in, right? Resting in you, it experiences the world. And so its emotional tenor is of yourself, not of these emotions. You see what I mean? So that's why somebody like Swamiji is so mature, so completely mature in his knowledge, that it was a really big foot in. It's very, so much always just everything that he would say or do was an expression of himself, whether it was toward anything internal or toward anything external. And it was just constant. That was the constant. And so when you were with him, you could be talking about anything or laughing or joking or just doing what people do in the world. But it was all taking place in that stability of his being. And then that his nishtha was so strong, you know, that when you were around him, you got to really enjoy that. I used to say the trees even light up when he's walking along. Just not because he's doing anything. It's because his mind, he's not doing anything. He's not trying to be like that. It's you wear your knowledge very lightly. It's just that he was very mature in his knowledge. As we all become mature in our knowledge, then the buddhi enjoying that naturally, at 1 foot in, so to speak, naturally enjoying that, experiences the world from that, from myself, not from samsara, not from ajnanam, not from these emotional issues. If they're emotional issues, then those are objectified and I take care of them in a kind way, inside and outside. It's another thing. I help what is going on inside and I help what is going on outside. Because for me, inside and outside are the same. Right? For me, what's the difference? Whether there's some emotional trauma going on internally in my mind or the unconscious or whatever, then the buddhi takes care of those things. Resting in me, I handle those things. There's some tumult going on out here. Resting in me, I take care of those things. Except when I don't. And when I don't, that's my sadhana, to come back home. It's not about emotional bypass at all. It's about having the freedom to be with all of those emotions in a knowledgeable way, in a healing way. All of those emotions, internal and external. All of the weather, as Vaagyeshananda will say, you have to be with the weather. Internal weather, external weather. Dress well for the weather. Yeah. Be cheerful. Be cheerful in the bad weather. Yeah. Handle it gracefully. Okay, that's good enough. Let's take some time. Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Maheshaha Go Brahmane Vyashivamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Pavantu Kale Varshati Parujanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Barahitaha Brahmanah santu nirbhayah. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah. Sarve santu niramayah. Sarve bhadrani pashyantu. Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet. Asato ma sadgamaya. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya. Mrityorma amitam gamaya. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. Hari Om. Yes.
That word, nirvikalpa.
Nirvikalpa.
Can you define it a little bit?
Nirvikalpa means when the mind is, the buddhi is very absorbed to the point that there's no distinguishable subject-object relationship. So in deep sleep, you have nirvikalpa. It's not nirvikalpa samadhi. It's nirvikalpa agnani, okay? Where the mind, which is normally functioning in a subject-object relationship, whether it's in dream or waking state, has gone into its causal condition where there's no subject-object duality. So in nirvikalpa, in samadhi, what happens is when I'm focusing on myself, the buddhi is focusing only on the self, there can take place a situation where any type of ahankara or subject-object relationship experience is not there. The example they use, because there's two terms, savikalpa and nirvikalpa, samadhi. So the example is if, say, you hold a candle flame up to the sun, think of the candle flame as your mind. Initially, if you're holding that candle flame up to the sun, you can see the outline of the candle, even though it's totally overwhelmed by the sun. So, but you can still, it's still recognizable. That would be like if I'm contemplating and the focus is on myself, just on my being, but I'm still aware of my mind focusing on myself. Mm-hmm. There's still the subject-object there. But if that subject, if that is held for any amount of time, it just naturally, it's not something that you would do, it naturally occurs that the nature of the self overwhelms the buddhi to the point that candle flame edge is not there. So at that moment, you're just abiding just as conscious being.
So is there any quality difference in samadhi and deep sleep?
Yeah, because in deep sleep, the mind isn't awake. In deep sleep, the mind itself is in a causal condition, which is pure jnana. In nirvikalpa samadhi, or there's many different types of meditation, but anyway, in this nirvikalpa samadhi, the mind is awake. Mm-hmm. It's not asleep. It's not resolved into unconscious, into ajnana, into ignorance, into its causal condition. It's awake. But it's resolved into awake. The focus is on your own being to the point that your own being overwhelms. It's like the clay overwhelming the pot. The pot loses its focus of its own potness, and is just abiding there as clay.
So the nirvikalpa is a little bit different.
Nirvikalpa really means, it's different than deep sleep, because deep sleep means the mind goes into its causal condition, which is pure jnana, it's maya.
Okay.
That's when I was giving those meditations on avyekta. There's two types of avyekta, unmanifest. One is maya going into its causal condition, the prakriti. And the other is the nama rupas, name and forms, go into avyekta, unmanifest condition. In the atma also, the atma is always avyekta. There is no, it's never not avyekta. You know, prakriti, the prakriti is avyekta, vyekta, avyekta, vyekta, because it comes into manifestation and goes into causal condition. Brahman is never not avyekta, because it's always free of nama rupa. And so it's completely different. The nice thing about deep sleep is when, like Swamiji will joke and say, you know, ignorant, total ignorance is bliss. It's got to be total, he'll joke. Total ignorance is bliss. Partial ignorance is a big problem. Total ignorance is bliss. Deep sleep, you know.
Deep sleep is a five-star hotel.
Yeah.
It occurred to me when you were saying like that the self, you know, using Puranaha and ancient and new, you know, and then, but it's sort of interesting. I think this is probably just a result of Dehatma Buddhi, but I think it, you know, because it's like, because then you often speak the self is so personal, you know, so then, yeah, the self is very personal, and then it's kind of like, so that personal is this piranha? You know what I mean? It's kind of...
Yeah, yes, I do. Now, the thing is, why when I go to say that this personal is because people think that there's a universal self. Okay? Not personal self, there's a universal self. And they'll say, because I remember this way these questions coming up in satsang, Swamiji. It's kind of like, I don't want to be a universal self. I want to be me. You know? And so, who wants to be a person? You know, or I don't want to be some soul that goes to heaven. Heaven and hell, I don't. Of course I don't want to go to hell, but I don't even want to go to some, to be a soul that goes to heaven, unless that's me, you know. So what the personal self versus the universal self is where that comes in. And that the you think that there, that you're going to discover that this self that I am is going to discover a universal self, but actually I don't care about the universal self. I care about me. So the discovery really is that this me, which is so personal, that makes me, that me is Brahman. And there's only one. It is very, very personal, but there's only one. And the me experience doesn't come from the mind or the mind-body sense organs. That's not where the me experience comes from. The me experience is the nature of yourself, so of the Atma. And so if you were to get rid of the whole universe, like in Chandogya, the Upanishad, you said roll it up like a piece of leather and throw it away, that's an example. Get rid of the entire universe, all duality, all time and space, the entire dream, you know. Then what is left is what? Me. Because you would think that the me belongs to, like, the dream character, to this, or the me experience. You have your me experience, you have your me experience. You can even say things like this, like, you know, in the example where, say there are, like we use, like say there's 15 people in the room, so there's 15 mirrors in the room. Okay? 15 mirrors all reflecting the sun. Okay. And so each... You would think each mirror has its own sun experience. Right? Each mirror has its own sun experience. And so like that, each one of us has our own individual me experience. And the me experience is really given to me by the mind which reflects the Atma. But the me experience is mine, and your me experience is yours, and your me experience is yours. That's what we tend to... to think, and that's the me experience I'm attached to. But the thing is that the me experience, it's like if I hold up a mirror, you know, say I hold up a mirror to my face, and having there a reflection of my face, but I'm not, the reflection of the face is not the experience of the face. See what I mean? If you hold it, you'll see the face in the mirror, but there's no the mirror's not having an experience of the face. I am the experience of the face. Do you understand? Like, in terms of me, say the mind has a me experience, but the me experience doesn't belong to the mind. It's not having the me experience. The me experience only belongs to the me experience, which is the self. And that's very personal.
So, yeah, but when those people were in the class... saying, I don't want to be a soul going to heaven unless that's just
me.
But probably some, at least, of those people referring to that they, if they were the soul going to heaven, they wanted to be this same personality and ego. And that should survive death, and I should be up there enjoying it, but still realize that I'm Bill Smith and all of that.
Yeah, but even when they're wanting to be Bill Smith and all of that, okay, they want... Bill Smith and the body and the mind and the sense organs, all of these upadis, is what makes me me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But that's not true.
Right.
They might think they have all kinds of different ideas. What I wasn't actually, and I totally understand what you're saying there, I think. I was saying something a little different for like religious people. They think that there's a soul that goes to heaven. Okay? But I don't know what that soul is. That soul's not me. I'm this body, mind, sense organs person here. And and there's some soul, who cares?
Okay.
Or if you say like this, there's a universal non-dual self. Mm. You know, that's the truth of the whole creation. Okay, but that's not really what I care about. What about me? You know, so you have to... And it's nice, okay, there's some universal self, but that's like, that's the same duality. There's me and that there's infinite, there's this infinite universal non-dual self. But I have a, what's my relationship with that, you know? Do I have to recognize I am that.
Do you think it's helpful to break through that in a way, if a contemplation of like, all of this is me? I mean, do you think that that's,
I like that contemplation. You have to unfold that probably before you do the contemplation. but Swamiji's doing that Karyakarana contemplation. I think it's really beautiful, actually. It's just how you just have to unfold it in a way that takes the mind to seeing that.
That was sort of my question too, because I feel like there's almost this inherent problem with meditation. Like, say you meditate every day, and you're withdrawing all your sense organs, and because of that, the feeling of yourself is a very internal feeling. Like, almost, it can't be otherwise because of the way that you're going about it.
Yeah,
know?
But there has to be, that's why there has to be a lot of, you have to get beyond your drisha viveka. So then when you're looking at, okay, you're withdrawing all of your sense experiences and then you're just abiding as conscious being. But then what has to happen is that when your mind comes out, you have to recognize that nothing has happened. So there's a lot of different kinds of experiences, I mean meditations that we have to do to make that clear. Even open-eye meditation is really good.
I don't think you've done any of those for a while.
Not open-eye?
Yeah.
You know where they do that really nicely on many different levels is in Drisha Viveka. There's a whole section where they go through many, many different types of meditation. But I think that what you're talking about, and one thing that has to happen, is that there's, and they're both necessary, the seer-seen differentiation, subject-object, so that you can recognize, it's like peeling off your clothes. I'm not this, neti-neti, I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not this. Then you've got rid of all of these things and you're just left with yourself. Right? But then you've thrown out all of this other stuff. So, but still, you need that because you need to recognize who you actually are without all these dresses on. But then what you have to do is be able to see that then you have to put it all back on and say, and then this is me, and this is me, and this is me, and this is me, and this universe is me. So that you recognize, once you've seen yourself, then you recognize that yourself actually is the very self of this dress, and this dress, and this dress, and this dress.
That's so the that's, turn.
Yeah. Yeah. It's called, it's going from this one prakriya called drisha, viveka, so you're seeing discrimination to karyakarana, cause-effect, in terms of the upadana karana, in terms of the material cause. That cause-effect, material cause and its form, resolves into satyam-mitya, that the effect itself has no being apart from the cause. And those, so we have to do more of those.
So you really have to see both. Then.
Oh yeah, you have to see both. You have to be able to say that. You have to recognize that the universe that you experience is not in any way separate from yourself.
Because otherwise, then the world is still outside you, and the problem
is
still a duality.
Yeah, it's forever.
You're kind of unified in the quote unquote yourself, but not.
Not. Yeah, you have to be able to say, "I am Ishwar." That's right. Exactly. That's the knowledge.
Once I heard Swami to say this, and I didn't really quite understand what he meant, but it just really stuck with me. It was a long time ago. He said, Vedanta swallows everything, and then it gives it back to you. And when it gives it back to you, it's completely different.
Yeah.
That's what he meant, right?
That can be both of those prakriyas. Mm. Yeah, you recognize that all of this is your own being. Mm. But it's not just in your head.
No.
Because there, the conscious being, right, is not just contained in this body. Everything enjoys that. And so the Dehatma, it breaks out of the Dehatma Buddhi. Conscious being breaks out of this conviction of it being a little pea in the pod. You know, existing just in this body.
But you know, you experience conscious being in the body.
But you don't really experience it in the body. Everything, there's no experience that doesn't enjoy that. Dehatma Buddhi puts it only in the body.
Yeah.
But actually, you can't have an experience that is not pervaded by that. You know. But the Dehatma Buddhi is hard because your five sense organs are located in the body. The sense of touch goes through the whole body. And so you always orientate yourself in reference to this body in reference to everything else. I'm here, and then I'm having the experience, all of this experience. And so the self just gets defined as being located in the body.
Yeah.
But and part of the problem for that also is the sense that the self is a knower. And the self is not a knower. The self is not a knower. It is conscious. It is consciousness. It is knownness, but it is not a knower.
So how is that a problem? I didn't quite get that.
Well, because you know through your sense organs, you know through your mind.
Oh, I see.
That's
really, that's a very pervasive mistake, isn't it? Identifying as the knower.
Of course, yeah, absolutely.
So that, as long as you're believing, that's kind of like, but identifying as doer, only it's the mental equivalent of that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I have to recognize
that I am a knower from the standpoint of my mind. I'm a seer from my ear standpoint, and my ears from the standpoint of my eyes, from my ears, etc.
Our whole Western culture is geared, I am the knower.
Anyone is in any culture. You're the knower and the doer.
Yeah.
But you have to then start to... And somebody might say, oh, you're Brahman, but you have no clue what that means. You could even believe it, and the Shastra says that, but it's not about believing. It's about knowledge. It's about really recognizing that even right at this moment, you're just, you're being, you just are. You're not doing anything. You're not knowing anything. But you're the conscious being because of which everything is known. See, actually, if you really analyze your experience, everything that you're experiencing right now is known. The self is known. The self is self-evident, and the is-knownness of the self is what everything enjoys. You don't experience a knower. You experience everything being known. We don't think like that.
Hmm. Yeah. That would
be a good one to do. Wow, that would be a good meditation.
We have some meditations like that, but yeah, we can do more. That's a really, really, very
That's
nice.
A really And then my favorite chant is Shiva, where it's, I am not the body, I am not the emotions, I'm consciousness, I'm Shiva.
That's the Drishta to get you to recognize your own being. But that in the recognition of your being, the knowership and doership and all these things get resolved. And it should be resolved right now when you know yourself. You know, you just simply are. You simply are self-evident, and everything shines after that. But language within samsara, within duality, is because identification of the body, mind, sense organs, I become a knower, a seer, a hearer, a doer, all these things, a thinker, a feeler.
English is very dualistic, whereas Sanskrit.
No, Sanskrit's dualistic too. They're all dualistic.
They're all dualistic.
But Sanskrit has a vocabulary that holds the Vedanta.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody?
Yeah.
Well,